of, but one person does not move. And that one person is the slave that he loves. And that one person stays in the room until it is totally empty. And all he does is look at his beloved. He doesn't despise the other people. He doesn't despise what they want. He doesn't despise the things that they are offered. He just knows one thing, which is that the beloved is all the wealth of the whole universe, all the treasure, and that there is nothing in this world, and no power and no dignity, and nothing that this world could ever offer us, which is in any way even an infinitesimally part as beautiful and as gorgeous as the illumination that the beloved can give to those that the beloved loves and who loves them. So he stares at him. And the king turns to him, and he says these words, which in your heart he will say to you at this moment of the part. He will say to you, because you have loved me more than anything else, I will give you everything that I am and everything. Then what will happen is that he will reward you with the great ordeal of the path. Nobody has ever described this ordeal more beautifully than Sheikh Ansari. And this is the great mystery of the path. This is the path from humanity to divine humanity. And it passes through a death. A death and annihilation of everything that you think you are, everything that you think you believe, everything you think you know. The great reward on the path is this death. And it's only given to those who have practiced and loved hard enough so they have built within themselves the enormous trust that can enable them to say with Halaj, trust you to kill me. When Al-Halaj was put in prison for saying he was one with God, Shebli, his friend, asked him, what is the love you speak of? Come tomorrow and I'll tell you, Al-Halaj answered. Tomorrow came and Shebli found him in front of the gallows where that day he would be hung, drawn, and quartered. And Al-Halaj looked at him and said, now you can see the answer. Love begins by seducing the eye. And love ends like this. Its noose gets tighter and tighter to squeeze out the self. And then comes the test of the cross. Stay if you don't understand. Stay if you do understand. If you don't, leave now. It is very hard to speak about annihilation because you are usually speaking about it as a still unannihilated self, to other unannihilated selves who want to cling on to what they know of themselves for as long as possible. So there is fear in the air. But I want to tell you a story that has helped me face this process as it unravels in me. And it has been for a long time now. I worked on my translations of Rumi with a woman called Eva Dvitre Meyerovich, who had the enormous distinction of being the first person to translate Rumi into a European language. She translated most of Rumi. When I met her, she was 80, feisty, mischievous, ebullient, crazily egocentric, and a fabulous person, juicy and intense and utterly, utterly devoted in an almost hallucinatory way to her beloved, who honestly she spoke of in the present tense and who was in the room with us every time, every day, every hour that we were working. It was an amazing gift and I will love her till my dying day. One day, it was November the 29th, I went to see Ava. Usually Ava came up with 42 projects that she had to do, 32 things that should have been done yesterday, 500 things that she was thinking, and a typewriter, very old, on which it all had to be done immediately. That was her style. It was the Prussian style. I like that style. It's a great, it's better than that loose style, you know. Oh, I don't mind. Perhaps tomorrow.
No.
I opened the door. There she was, absolutely in tears. She was beside herself. I said, what on earth is the matter? I've never seen you like this. And he said, don't you know what day this is? And I said, November 29th. This is the day, perhaps, that Rumi met Shams. Why are you crying? This is the great day of the world. This is the day when the greatest mystical love affair, which has irradiated the whole world, began. And he said, she said, you're so young, she said, you're so stupid, she said, I don't know why I'm wasting my time with you. Don't you know what that dreadful, terrible, gorgeous man put Rumi through? So have you any idea? And she really lost it. And for 20 minutes, she went through Rumi's life. Agony by agony, stripping by stripping, death by death, horror by horror, until I was really reeling. She said, you've got to face what this enormous gift has come from, what this great fountain of rapture and joy and initiatory bliss has come from. It has come from a crucifixion. And that crucifixion was in perfectly organized stages by the beloved. First he meets Shams, which is terrible enough to be faced with so fierce and incandescent and truthful a being whom you love with your whole being. Then he has to be stripped. Then Shams has to go away because the disciples are jealous. Then he has to yearn with his whole being and race around Asia Minor to find him. Then he does find him. Then he comes back. Then there's this last astounding year in which they communicate intensely and totally to each other. And then only 3 years after he met him, there is a knock at the door. Sham says something like, it is finished. He goes to the door, is never seen again, and is probably murdered by Rumi's own son. So the beloved, the one that he knew, was bringing in the fire of the divine beloved and the fire of a revelation of love which was destined to transform the whole of humanity. That one whom he had become one with was murdered by his own son, probably. Can you begin to imagine what happened next? What happened next is that he went mad. He went so crazy that everybody feared for his life. And out of him poured for the first time these torrents, these cries of mystical poetry. And he went crazier and crazier and more disheveled and more agonized until the astounding realization burst in his brain that Shams was not dead. Shams could never be dead. They could never be separated because he and Shams and the beloved were one in eternal love beyond space and beyond time. And then Shrumi was born. The fusion of their two consciousnesses that this amazing illumination comes from was born and lived for the next 30 years in gathering serenity and strength. Just imagine for a moment what that process was like. And Ava that day said to me, she said, you know, I am really angry at God, she said. I wish that he have to make Mevlana suffer so much. Why? And I had absolutely no idea, of course, at that time, because, I mean, imagine this 80-year-old feisty Prussian lady screaming at you and shouting and falling on the floor. And she said, well, I'll give you an answer I was given once, which has consoled me and helped me, she said. When she went to Konya, she had an overwhelming experience at the tomb. She went back to her room, and then she had an overwhelming experience of the crucifixion that led to the resurrection of the tomb. And for 3 days, she wept and wept and wept in her room for the beauty of this love that Rumi had allowed to tear him apart like a black lion so that he could give this enormous gift of deathless passion to the world. And then at the end of those 3 days, being Ava, instead of being reconciled, she got angry at God. So she went back to Rumi's tomb, and she stood in front of Rumi's tomb when nobody else was there, and she said to Mevlana, she said, I don't understand this, and you have got to help me. I think even Mevlana would be moved by Ava. And what happened then was that she went out, and there by the little bird fountains outside was an old Turkish man sitting. And she went and she was crying, and he said, what are you crying about? He said. And she said, well, I'm crying about Fana. I'm crying about crucifixion. I'm crying about the necessity of the death of the path. We've already been through so much. My God, why do we have to go through that? And he laughed and he laughed and he laughed. He said to her the following two amazing things. He said, look at that rose bush and look at that gorgeous full rose at the top. When that rose bush was planted, it was to create that gorgeous full open rose, wasn't it? Yes. Well, just imagine what the rose bush went through before it got even to being above the ground. It's planted from the origin. It's planted in the earth. It's watered. It has to go through all those seasons. It gets up onto the ground. It's got its little thorns. It then has to be protected by practice. It then has to grow and grow and grow through all these makams and stages that we've been describing. Then it has to grow branches, doesn't it? Doesn't it? And then on those branches, if you're lucky and if it survived and if the animals haven't eaten it, on those branches appear buds, gorgeous buds, pregnant, juicy, ripe, rich with invisible perfume and the invisible glory of the open rose. But something has to happen to those buds before they can become the totally open rose, exposing its heart to the world and giving the perfume of that heart to all beings. Those buds have to be broken open. They have to be. So that the entire richness that has been developed in them through their long growth can now display itself in mirror dance with the sun that has been yearning them upward. That is an astounding way of seeing annihilation as the breaking open of the bud, so that the divine human rose of each of our natures can finally flower as Jesus flowered on the cross, as Rumi flowered in madness, as all lovers flower in total surrender. Have you seen Castaway? You must, because that is about annihilation. And there is this astounding moment right at the end when all the tricks have failed. He's lost his only companion, which is a baseball, and he's just lying there on the raft, sobbing, helpless, finally aware of the nothingness he is and the helplessness of the situation without God. And it is at that moment that providence starts unrolling its golden carpet. And he actually almost doesn't awaken when the ship that is to save him passes by. It's an astounding film and an astounding study of all the different stages that the divine has to take you so that you can see and know beyond any shadow of a doubt that you and the rest of human beings are nothing. Up to this moment in the past, you're pretty proud of yourself. You're having all these visions and dreams, and you're respected, and you're writing these books, and it's fantastic. And you think, well, I and the beloved are really, you know, getting pretty close now. But the problem in that sentence is the I. And what has to go is that I. Up to this moment, the actual organizational self has been intact. What annihilation does is to, in the terms of your own temperament and life, send you exactly the disasters tailored for you to unravel you. Rumi puts it like this. He says, when at last the divine is ready and sees that you love him enough, he will send you the most terrible and gorgeous of all graces. Agonies will crowd you from all directions to drag you at last into the directionless. And nothing is more amazing the truth of those last words, because those begin the life of union, the transition from Fana to Baka, the life of living with the constant inner knowledge that you and the divine are normally one, and that the divine is living in you, and you are one of the drops in the divine's ocean. But, and this is very important, the temptations are not. Many people and many paths believe that just by reaching there, which you would have thought would be enough, wouldn't you, that it would be over. You're one in certain ways with the one, and you are filled with the divine normality, and you are able consciously to see and breathe the divine world. But there is one last temptation which can destroy the whole meaning of the path, can derail you permanently, and can make you the slave, not of the authentic divine, but of that which tries to unravel the work of the divine in the world. And that temptation is known in all the secret esoteric traditions as the temptation to transcendence, the temptation to the addiction to transcendence. It's very easy to see why you would be addicted to transcendence at this moment. You've struggled through all these veils to see the light, to know the light, and the great temptation then is to go off into the light and to think that all of this, this world, this creation, these people, these animals, are just shiftings in a dream, and to focus totally on the one as being, forgetting that the one is also becoming. To focus totally on the one as light, forgetting that the one is also all of the manifestations of the light, from the tiniest flea to the greatest whale, to the transvestite dancing in the streets in Rio, to the poor whose screams deserve to be heard, to the child that is raped, to the dying dolphin. All of those are also the beloved. And so there is one great temptation which you have to overcome. And the only way to overcome that great temptation is to love the beloved so much that you really, really, really find the courage to be one with the beloved, not only in the light, but in this suffering, dying, screaming, howling, bloody creation. And that begins the life of birthing. Because once you have truly chosen the motherhood of God for all creation, the divine feminine aspect of God as love in action, and once you have truly chosen not to float off into the great transcendence, but with the powers and blisses and knowledge of that transcendence to come here and bring the light down, ground the light, earth the light, and express the light in radioactive creativity and passion for justice and real fierce action in the world, once you have made that supreme decision in and for the beloved, what you are then given are the powers of the beloved to effect enormous change and to become a radioactive nuclear secret agent of the beloved's work in time. And I want to stress that because I want to say one thing from the bottom of my heart. Love the beloved as the transcendent, of course, always and forever. But know that Allah has a veil of mercy, which is Mary, which is the creation, which is this world. And know that the highest experience of non-duality is simply not available to the one who chooses only the serenity of being. The highest experience of non-duality is only available to the lover who is mad enough to say to God, I will love like you. I will serve like you. I will bless like you. I will pour myself out like you. And like you, I will see you in absolutely all things and all beings. And I will give my life as a slave to you to see justice and mercy done here and to work for your real plan, which is nothing less than the transfiguration of this world into a living mirror of your truth and your justice and your beauty. And that is the highest choice. It's the last choice. It's the death choice beyond death choices, because it commits you to a life of the gambler. And Rumi puts it astonishingly in the Mathnavi. He says, being a gambler is much better than being a teacher or master or sheikh or being a holy person or being even enlightened. He said, forget it. Forget it. Those are all positions. And the greatest teachers, of course, are never in the position of maybe playing it, but they are never there when they're in their private place. They're on their knees begging for the light to sustain them and to give them wisdom. This is Rumi on this stage. He says, listen and realize that love is recklessness, not reason. Reason seeks a profit, but love comes on strong, consuming herself, unabashed. Yet in the midst of suffering, love proceeds like a mill wheel, hard surfaced and straightforward. Having died to self-interest, She risks everything and asks for nothing. Love gambles away every gift that God bestows. Gambling yourself away is beyond any religion and is the real business of Sufis. Religions seek grace and favor and awakening, but those who gamble themselves away just for love's sake are God's favorites. And one last quotation before I just say what I've been wanting and leading up to say all day. Believe me, what you come to experience is this, I think, and it will shock you and humble you and amaze you and astound you and utterly reduce you and utterly overwhelm you and transform you forever into the lover that serves. This is from Hayuna, who's a 9th century Sufi, I think. When I found this quotation, I couldn't read anything for the rest of the day. I felt, at last the truth of unity and union is being told. And this truth is told throughout the Sufi tradition, although, of course, like all other mystical traditions, the temptation to transcendence is one that besets the Sufi tradition, just as it does all others. So it's something to be very, very careful about. Very careful. Whoever loves God will win his friendship. Whoever becomes joyful will fill with desire. Whoever is full of desire will become bewildered. Whoever becomes bewildered will become brave. Whoever becomes brave will reach him. Whoever reaches him will enter into union. Whoever enters into union will become a knower. Whoever becomes a knower will be drawn near. And whoever draws near will never fall asleep. And the rays of sublime heartbreak will engulf him. You're not going to a place of peace and omnipotence and omniscience. You're going to a place where your whole being is so totally exposed to the divine beloved in surrender that the divine beloved can give you its last and final gift, which is the gift of feeling the infinite pain in its heart for the madness of the creation and suffering of the creation. And if from that moment you, as Bhai Sahib said, you learn how to bear the heat and the burden, what will be revealed to you and in you is a life more difficult than you can imagine and more beautiful than you can imagine. And I beg you now to take that challenge for the whole path and to know yourselves equipped for the path and to know that every stage you will be helped by the divine that wants you to complete that path as far as you can in this life. For one very important reason, which is that the world in its contemporary total crisis needs mystical activists as much as it needs oxygen. I think, in fact, that the future of the world depends upon the meaning in the deepest sense of those two words, mystical activism. An activism in favor of all the things that need to be done for the environment, for the poor, for all these things, that is not rooted in the mystical knowledge, in the mystical stamina, in the mystical peace, in the mystical rapture, will simply burn out in the face of the horrible defeats that power in place will endlessly inflict upon it, and burn out in face of the coma of denial of what is happening that is afflicting this planet like a great invisible plague. But a mysticism that is not active, that does not take on the burden of the rays of sublime heartbreak, that does not see the beloved in the poor, and the beloved in the dolphin, and the beloved in the whale, and the beloved in the burning forests, and does not feel the burning of the forest in their own body, and does not know that that person crying for bread at the street corner is you crying for bread at the street corner, that will not face, because it's so drunk on its own version of the path, that the whole meaning of the path is to love enough, to be able to open enough to the pain and the suffering and the misery and the madness, and then to dedicate everything that you are and everything that you've been given by God to eradicate that pain and to be the end of that misery, so that it will end at last. And God's real reign of love and justice and mercy be brought through in the core of your actions. That is what is needed now in this great spiritual renaissance that is trying to be born. A very profound sense of the path and a very profound sense that real non-duality does not end in an abstraction from reality, but in a total deathless embrace of it. Think of this. This is the cross, isn't it? This is the yes. But the yes has two hands, doesn't it? It's a yes to joy and it's a yes to pain. It's a yes to life and it's a yes to death. It's a yes to rapture and it's a yes to agony. It's a yes! You can't do it if you just do one. You really can't. And when you find from the depths of yourself the non-dual courage to do this, what you will find is that the beloved will be standing right here doing that too, and your hearts will be communicating directly, and lava from the beloved's heart will be flowing into yours. And you will be the humble, irradiated child of non-dual love, a radioactive nuisance at play in the fields of the Lord. Thank you very much. As usual, I have gone on. But I'd like you to take all of that in. I hope it was valuable to you. Has anybody got a Kleenex? Oh my God, be satisfied with your lovers. May the death of lovers be holy. May your beauty be a feast for them. May their souls burn like incense in your fire. Oh, beloved, you have spilled our blood with our own hand. May that same hand also bloody our soul. May anyone who says, save him from love, have his prayer chased from heaven. On the path of love, the moon dwindles and disappears. May this dwindling from love become a fullness. Others demand a respite from death, but lovers cry out, no, let it come fast. Heaven is made of the smoke of hearts that burn away. Praises to all those who are burned. Heaven is made of the smoke of hearts who burn away. Rumi also said something so beautiful in the table talk. He said, do not give me empires or fame. Give me that burning in the heart that calls God secretly in the night, because that is the treasure. Someone like to ask something? Don't be shy. Sir, is there a microphone available for this gentleman? What is your name, sir? Jalaluddin. Ah, wonderful.
Name that I've been given. When I've been given that name, I said, I don't have that power of faith, which is a translation of Jalaluddin. And he said, well, that's why I gave it to you.
They always have a good answer.
Very good answer. I have a million questions, but I'll limit myself to one or two. First of all, gratitude for your splendid, magnificent presentation. I know this won't inflate your head, but I'm simply stating how you spoke to me.
How can a man of totally enlightened being come inflated?
That's right. That was my point. So,
if you believe that, you believe anything.
What you have done for me is to put my life into perspective. And I've always resisted the tragedies, the agonies, the bankruptcy, the despair over the misery that exists all over this beloved planet. I've been in jail, I've done it all. No, I haven't done it all, but I've done some. And you put it into a perspective where I can accept those trials and tribulations without resentment or without blaming God. So I wanted to thank you.
Sometimes I truly believe they are love's greatest, God's greatest gifts to us. Mm-hmm. They're the marks of real love.
Yeah. You said at the end, and I totally empathize with the statement where you said what the world needs is mystical activists. When I spoke to people like Pierre Vilayat of the Sufi Order of the West, he emphasized that you don't totally eliminate the I. And in order to be an activist as a mystical, you have to...
Is that your question?
Yes, that is my
question. That's a very good question. Okay. The point about fana is not the destruction of the I completely, because otherwise you could no longer function.
Right.
The personality is not destroyed, it is totally remade. There are three images that might help. The first is the image that I tried to give yesterday of Rumi, the bird flying into the sun, held at exactly the right distance from the sun so that you still see the outline of the bird, but the body is irradiated with light. A second image that might help for Baka, for this, the life in the divine, is like a lens, that the self, instead of becoming opaque, being opaque, becomes a lens through which the rays of the divine names can be focused in reality. The third image comes from Rumi himself, and as you would imagine, it's a dazzling image because he's really, he can tell what he knows what he's talking about. And he says, the self that has been through annihilation is like a horse that you have, a dead horse that you've thrown into a lime pit. The outline remains, but the what's inside the outline is no longer horse, but lime. Isn't that beautiful? So the personality remains. And in fact, in many ways, that's one of the things that always amazes me that people could think, for example, that the personality of the Dalai Lama has been eliminated. The Dalai Lama has more personality than everybody in this room combined because he is living as his essential person. Do you see what I'm saying? What you become on the path is not a totally, what I call, a radiant ghost too heavenly to be of any earthly use, which is some people's version of what annihilation means. What you actually become is totally juicy, totally focused, and all of your powers and everything you are and everything that you do given up to the, as far as possible, to the divine self. So that makes you incredibly effective because the personality, instead of being the organizer, becomes the instrument of the divine self for its expression in the world. So that's what happens. And it's very important, that distinction, because the words like annihilation can lead you to the... And who would want to be... I don't want to be nothing. I want to be Andrew. And I know that Andrew is simultaneously nothing and everything. And I know that Andrew was created uniquely by the Beloved. I give the Beloved that much credit. To be Andrew, not to be Jennifer, and not to be Llewellyn, and not to be anybody, not to be Rumi even, but to be completely, essentially the divine person that I am. And I think that's why when somebody has realized or is beginning to realize that divine personality in themselves, they come over very strong. It's because they are very strong. And that selfhood in them that can seem arrogance or is in fact the pungency, the fragrance of the rose. The rose's fragrance can make you real.
Without any introduction. Shiva, let me think. Yes, Shiva is considered in the Hindu Trinity as the god of death. And I've always been, I've always had problems with that, and I've reinterpreted Shiva for me as a god of transformation.
Yes.
But at the same time, the two are sort of...
Well, how could they be? Yeah. Look, the whole point of the path is to get over these idiotic distinctions. You know that the thing that you call life when you're ignorant is death. It's death. It has no illumination. It's boring. It's flat. It's sad. It's bleak. It's death. You might as well be dead. And the thing that you fear as death is life. And that what you call death, even in what we call human death, is not death. It's going through a door into a life whose glory we can only just begin to imagine. So all of our information is wrong. All of the paradoxes are there. And Shiva is not just the god of destruction. Shiva is the god of creation and destruction together. And you see creation and destruction together, and you see in between the smile. The smile that knows that both are emanations of the one beyond both.
And the dance.
And the dance. And this is what the Sufi is. This is what happens at the last stages, I think, of the path, is that you become the dancer, not the master, not the sage, but the lover, the child, and the dancer. They're much freer. And that's why Rumi was so adamant in his refusal of the titles and the dignities, because he knew they were dust and ashes in the hurricane of Dimanga. And he wanted to represent something more glorious than that, which he glimpsed, which was the glory of the dance, the glory of divine childhood, the glory of freedom. And if that boy who came to him had gone on believing that Rumi was some enlightened being and that occasionally Rumi might glance at him and he'd have another mystical experience, then the projection would have kept the illusion going that Rumi was something other than he was and that he was something other than he was, and what he was and is the eternal beloved. So let's get over this model. Let's speak to each other as lovers and dancers. And let's electrify the lover and dancers in ourselves. That's what I profoundly believe is trying to get born here, another way of communicating. And I think it comes partly through Rumi, because the secret of that relationship between Shams and Rumi, you can go through many of the most turgid books in the world, written, I'm afraid, often by Sufis, in which you'd think that this relationship was a relationship between Shams, total, omniscient, enlightened, Rumi, poor, helpless slave, suffering disciple at the feet of Shams. This is not the relationship. They had a relationship of equals. Shams needed Rumi as much as Rumi needed Shams. Without Rumi, Shams' realization could never have informed somebody enough to burst on the world. Shams was an electrifying revelation without a voice. Rumi became his voice. Without Plato, Socrates would have died in Athens and there would have been no memory of Socrates. They needed each other. And their relationship was not a relationship of master and disciple only, although it was that at moments. It was a relationship of lover and beloved. And at the depths of that relationship, there is both slavery and total equality. That's the lunacy of the relationship. And that, I believe, is the true relationship of the teacher to the taught, of lovers like us sharing it. And it's a relationship that's very hard to find, because the person who's trying to establish it has to be in that relationship. And so we all fail, because we're all brought up on the model of authority, which is not quite yet love. And I myself have had to struggle hugely to overcome that in myself, and I'm sure I haven't yet, but I'm trying, because I know it's a fiction. Am I making sense to you? And the clue for me is Rumi bowing in the dark. I cannot get that story out of my head, because I met so few teachers in my whole ramblings around whom I could conceive of as bowing in the dust to anybody. I'm not sure I could, but I know I want to. Do you see what I'm saying? We have to, all of us, travel to that place in which that radical and gorgeous humility becomes a natural part of the way we live and breathe, and then the miraculous dance will happen naturally. Is there any question, any other question? Madam, a woman.
My name is Habiba.
Hello, Habiba.
Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, if you love someone, you should tell them.
You should tell them.
You should tell them. Oh. And I like to tell you I love you.
Thank you. I love you back. Thank you. Thank you very much. Can I read you to... sir.
Thank you for what you've given us.
Thank you, sir.
The path is obviously a slippery slope. So it would seem, yes, to behoove one to have a guide and a teacher.
Yes.
Since you are starting, I'm starting at the bottom. How do
you're not sick. Don't say that.
All right.
Well, I think you have to be very careful. I think you, I might for myself make a distinction between teacher and guru. I think it's an important distinction because a teacher is somebody you can argue with, a teacher is somebody you can respect and even revere, but you don't have to idolize and you don't have to idealize. A teacher for me is two things. A teacher is teaching you always how to learn by modeling learning to you, by showing you the sincerity, the earnestness, the nakedness, the ability to admit mistakes, the suffering, the shadow that arises that comes with real learning on the real path. And the other thing that a teacher always does, in my opinion, is that a teacher never, ever, under any circumstances, ever, ever claims to be enlightened. Ever. A real teacher, if they'd had the real experience, would know that those words mean nothing before the endless transformations in love. And so a real teacher would be the servant, would be the lover, would be the dancer, and would be someone who was constantly giving back to you the image of your own secret divinity and not wanting anything from you, not wanting any power, not wanting any money, not wanting any favors of any conceivable kind, just the joy of sharing with you as your brother, sister, friend, the joys of divine life. That is the new, that's the ancient idea of a teacher, actually. Since then, we've had this other fantasy which has taken over and which has had its uses and has helped people. But the time of that fantasy, I think, is now over because something has to break through the projections. Very few people in my experience are really worthy of dealing with those projections. Can you imagine if you are adored and people think that you are omniscient and that you do all of this? I mean, it goes to your head. It does terrible things to both teacher and student very often. And there are very few people on either side of that who are equipped for that kind of relation, in my experience. Some of them, I hope, are in this room. Otherwise, I'm making a big mistake in being here. But if you are really looking for a teacher, check that teacher out. Check out if they are truly humble, if they truly walk their talk, if they're truly living free from the need from anything, if they are really humble about their own mistakes, their shadows and faults, if they're willing to discuss those with you and how they deal with them themselves, and if they are all of those things, get down on the ground, cry Allah, 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 kiss their feet, and don't do everything they say, but listen to what they say. That is my advice. And I was very lucky because I've met terrible teachers and amazing teachers. And I'm glad I met the terrible ones because they gave me forever an image of the corruption of power, which has permanently seared my mind. And I met an amazing and a man called Bede Griffiths, who was a great mystic and a Catholic priest, who when I rushed in one day, having seen him in the sky surrounded by light, turned to me and said, Andrew, don't exaggerate, it was the Holy Spirit. Now, come along. And that was the best thing. And Bede, who I saw dying, in the long process of his dying, used to say to me in the middle of the night sometimes, you're going to go further than me. And I said, further than you? He said, yes, because you can bless your sexuality in a way I could. Now, that is a teacher, because he, this gorgeous, illumined being who was dying in a sacred way, was reaching out to another person, and not trying to use all this glamour to seduce that person, even in the deepest way, but to give them the present of their own courage, their own self. And I'll tell you another story, which is also a wonderful way of telling whether a real teacher is a real teacher. One day, I was interviewing Bede for a television film that I made about him. We were sitting in his amazing little hut, sort of falling down in the middle of the field. I mean, nothing grand about Bede. He had three or four rags and, what a man. Asking him about what had happened to him in recent years. He was 86. He said, well, quite honestly, more has happened in the last 3 years than ever before in my life. He said, I had a stroke, the mother hit me over the head, she invaded me, and all kinds of non-dual experiences started to happen. And this is what they feel like, and he described them. And then he looked up at me and he said, well, of course, if I'm not like that all the time, you know. Sometimes it all goes dark, sometimes I'm totally bewildered, sometimes I don't understand anything, sometimes I'm confused, and then you know what I do? I sit and I pray, I empty myself, and guidance comes. That was, for me, the perfect teaching. Because on the one hand, he was saying, here is this glory. Here is this amazing experience. It is real. I know it. I'm living it. But he wasn't using his living of it as a way of ensnaring me, because, and simultaneously, because he was a man of perfect simplicity and perfect honesty, he was saying, quite frankly, it's not like that all the time, because I have to work at it like anybody, or it has to work at me. So he gave me the glory and the work. He gave me the splendor and the radical, naked, honest humility that's required if you're really going to take the path, staying naked at every moment. So him I count as a supreme teacher and always will honor as my teacher. And he warned me, the last thing he said to me, he said, don't you idealize me, he said, because my love for you goes beyond all of this. And I have felt that sense, because his love for me was the love Spirit, which doesn't need titles, because it just is, like the sea is, like the wind is, like the rose is. I want that kind of love, and I want that kind of teacher, because I need my mentors to have that kind of radical nakedness. And I think a lot of people now really are wanting that, because I think that they've understood that the other has grave limitations. And potential great glories, obviously, otherwise it wouldn't have lasted so long. But I think that there is an alternative way of doing it, and that is the way that I really want to mirror as far as I can. Because anybody who thinks that I'm enlightened after what I've displayed to you is really wrong. Anybody who thinks I don't have a shadow is out of their minds, and anybody who thinks I'm not struggling with all kinds of things is out of their minds. But I have seen what I'm talking about, and I can help you. But I can help you not as a guru, and not as a master, and not as a teacher, but as your brother, and as your friend, and as a lover of the beloved. That is my position. And I think you're more likely to accept it from a friend than from somebody standing above you in some way. I don't feel above anybody anymore. I think once you've been through even a glimpse of annihilation, you're like Tom Hanks, only some part of you is totally smashed forever. I feel, actually, sometimes as if I'm the two Andrews, that there's an Andrew inside who is just hopelessly smashed, and Humpty Dumpty will never be able to get himself together again. And then there's this Andrew that can write and talk and help. And I'm glad that I have the smashed Andrew as a reminder constantly of the dangers of inflation and pride, because it's very tempting. And I ask you, if you ever see any signs of it in me, to write me furious letters. I mean it. I want you to check my nonsense. And I think this is the real thing that you as students can give to your teachers, is to call them on their stuff. Call them tenderly with gratitude, but call them. It will help them and it will help you. I hope I haven't ruffled any beautiful feathers by saying all of that. Because it's truly meant out of love. It's my position, and there are other positions. And honestly, everyone is free to choose. But you asked me, and I told you. Sir.
Of the path.
Yes.
And what always comes to me is, how is this possible? In keeping a relationship, going to work, paying the bills,
that's the
paying
challenge.
Rent, and experiencing fauna and baka all at the same time.
I promise you it is. And the reason why I can say that is not because, I mean, I wish I could say that I've achieved total resurrection, but I can't. But what I can say is that I know beings who have, and Rumi is one of them. You know, when you go to Konya, you have the most tremendous shock. I had the shock. I thought that Rumi would live in some sweet, lovely, secluded place. Rumi didn't live in a sweet, lovely, secluded place. Rumi lived in the center of a bustling, wild city. He lived as a father. He lived as a husband. He lived as a grandfather. He lived as the advisor to emirs and God knows who. He lived as a teacher of butchers and bakers and candlestick makers. He lived as a supreme mystical poet. He lived as somebody who was in perpetual adoration. And he lived all of those lives simultaneously to show definitively forever that the real life is lived in the core of reality. And in fact, I think if you really are going to press me, and I think you probably want me to say what I'm about to say, is that I really think that that is the real way to live the realization. If you separate yourself too much from the world, the friction of daily reality and the incredible annoyance of other people existing. Have you noticed that that's the most annoying thing about life? Is that there are other people here. This is very, very upsetting, I find. When you bring this, when you're you can go off for a year. I've done it in my childhood, and I mean, I call it my childhood. In my 20s and 30s, I went off to the most splendid, lonely monasteries. I had revelations and the 32 kinds of emptiness. And then I came back and I swore at a waitress on the second day after my, what does it mean? Right? You have to integrate the experience in life. And I think having a partner who will call you on your BS is terribly important on the part. And I'm sure that Mira Khatun wasn't the sort of helpless, sweet lady who just brought in sweetmeats that she's represented in Aflaki. I'm sure there were times when the doors were closed when she said, hey, Jalaluddin, you can fool them with all your stuff about love and divine love. But yesterday, you were so impatient with me when I tried to come in. What do you think that is about? How dare you treat me like that? You have to have somebody who is in your face. And the more people you have in your face, that is called normal life, the more you will be ground to pieces by the mortar of humility. Because what real life does for you is to give you a constant reality check about your own realization. Haven't you noticed? I noticed for one thing that whenever I make what I consider to be a terrific leap, you know, Andrew's terribly pleased, he's taken this huge leap, he's written this, and almost immediately I do something so stupid and vulgar that it's as if the beloved is saying, okay, you know, this might all be radiant with divine light, but look at the stain here. Get on your knees and scrub. Do you see what I'm saying? I don't only believe that the total realization can, I think it can only come in the world. And I think this is why the great majority of Sufi teachers have lived in the world, because they have wanted what I call, what I've been trying to represent as the total non-dual relationship. You see, one of the most beautiful things about Rumi for me is that he loved cats. I didn't discover this until I went to Konya, and it sealed my eternal love for him forever, because I'm mad about cats. If you read Aflaki, you'll find out that Rumi wasn't just giving these amazing teachings and radiating divine bliss. He also adored animals. And this is a tremendous clue for me of the awakening. Because once you see the beloved in everything, you're hopelessly in love with every slug and flea and dancing dolphin. I mean, it takes everything that you have not to stroke every living being. You have to keep your hands to yourself. And one of the things that moved me so much about Rumi is that when Rumi was dying, his cat was yowling and howling. After he died, left, his cat refused to eat. And his daughter buried his cat by him. So that cat is lying in glory with him forever. Because, as she said, Rumi was a friend to all creation. But I think what Rumi experienced was the divine life in eating with his family, the divine life in stroking the belly of his cat, the divine life in being infused by the radiance of the beloved. But who's to say where he experienced it more at the end of his life? Perhaps it was lying in bed with his pussycat and with her face against his, listening to her purr, that he heard the most intimate secrets of the beloved whispered to him. When the whole sun comes up and all of life comes up irradiated with it, then wherever you turn, you are seeing only God. And whatever you are doing in that state, you are doing only God. And that, of course, includes making love to the person you love and honor and celebrate and are faithful to. And it even includes things like going to the toilet. Everything is divinized. It's worth it. I only glimpse this state, but I know it's real. I just know it's real. It's the state of fullness and freedom, openness and naturalness, and it needs no title and no dignity, because it is everything. And all is sacred in it, including giving business calls. You don't have to protect that much a true realization. What you have to do is fuel it by constant prayer. Does that make sense? That's what I've discovered. Against my will, by the way, because I'm a natural seclude. You won't believe it, but I am a natural solitary. And I've just been dragged around by the beloved for these last years. And I have been too exhausted to get up sometimes, and then I know what to do. I know to get down on my knees and pray so that I'm given the words to say in the right way. And they come, and they're not, I mean, I'd like to say they're not mine, but of course some of them must be mine, because otherwise they would be perfect. But a lot of them come from somewhere else, and the energy comes from somewhere else, because once you've really given up, you can do amazing things in the middle of the nightmare, which is precisely where you are meant to do them. We are meant to keep love alive in hell. And who would need hell after this world? And at this time. Am I making sense to you? Let me read you one poem. Or even two. Don't worry. I am not going to go off. I'm going to just read you some beautiful things. You're not trapped in this room forever hearing me talk. Even wisdom gets tiring, don't you find? Let's have a joke. I love Nasruddin. Have you discovered Nasruddin yet? Ah, good for Nasruddin. Everybody must let out their inner Tina Turner and their inner Nasruddin. I have a Tina Turner t-shirt on, but I'm not going to show you. There is a Sufi. Talk about a Sufi! When she comes on stage, the whole place explodes with joy. And she stays there and she sings of pain and heartbreak and agony, and she makes it glow with the blood of the beloved. It is simply astounding. And they think, oh, she's just a rock and roll artist. Listen up. There are these amazing sacred artists out there. And they're doing it in the arena. Tina Turner is doing it in the middle of the Oakland arena. She did it. She created a great mass of divine love there in which people reeled out, not with their ears boiling with noise, but irradiated and turning to each other and talking to each other, because she is a humble servant of divine passion and able to do it in rock and roll. My God, what God is just laughing and laughing and laughing up there. Callas is another one. They're all out there. They're usually women, but there are some men. Nasruddin addressed a large crowd and shouted, "Do you want knowledge without ordeal? Truth without lies? Attainment without any hard work? And progress without sacrifice?" Everyone yelled, "Yes!" He said, "Great! I do too. And if I ever find out how to manage it, I'll be thrilled to let you know." I love that one. And one serious one and one beautiful one. When you come to the period of your killing, keep this poem by your bedside, because it's a poem which will remind you about what this process is about, the breaking open of the bud to reveal the rose. And it's naturally, it's by the master of crucifixion and resurrection, Jalaluddin. "Whatever the blow that arrives from heaven, wait to receive a robe of honor afterwards. He is not a king who thrashes you and then does not give you a crown and a throne to rest on. This world is worth less than the eye of a mosquito, yet for a single real blow there is infinite reward. Take from your neck now the world's gold collar. Receive with no protection the blow God sends. Didn't the prophets receive blows on their necks? That pain is what forced them to hold their heads high. Never abandon your innermost core even a moment, so the beloved will always find you at home. Otherwise, he'll remove his robe of honor and say, 'I came to see you myself and found no one in.'" You have to stay in the fire until the to do so because you know what is killing you is birthing you. And love is a terrible alchemy that leads to a tremendous radiance. And that is simply that. And it's never been more beautifully expressed than in these three lines by a 14th century Sufi, which the whole path is in. When your heart is consumed with longing and burned to ashes, the breeze of love arises and sweeps up the ashes and fills heaven and earth with the utterly burnt one. It's the face of Jesus in the face of Rumi, isn't it? And lastly, just three short poems by Sheikh Ansari. And thank you so much for this wonderful morning. You've given me a tremendous gift by being so open. You've allowed me to be open with you. And if I've hurt you in any way, or offended you in any way, or upset you in any way, please forgive me. It's just that I'm English. And please, please question everything that I've said to you. Test it and see if it works for you. Don't buy it because it comes wrapped in this Oxford package. See if it's real for you. And if it isn't, I will be the first to rejoice if you rush out and stamp on it and throw it away. Sheikh Ansari. Oh Lord, give me eyes that see nothing but your glory. Give me a mind that finds joy in your service. Give me a soul drunk on the wine of your wisdom. O Lord, may my mind reel with revelations of you. May my heart blaze with the mysteries of your grace. May my tongue move only to sing your praise. O Lord, give me a heart I can pour out in thanksgiving, and give me life so I can spend it working for the salvation of the world. May we all come to say those words with every cell of our body and to know the intimate union of ourselves with the beloved, and then to risk acting as the beloved.